All right, well, this morning again, we are privileged to have Mrs. Lars Grin, better known to many of you as Elizabeth Elliott, with us this morning. It was as late, in fact, it's been a very short night for all of us. It was this morning about 1:30. My wife is still poking me, reviewing the questions and the answers that we went over last night. And so this is just pretty much going to be a continuation from our discussion last night and then in my own home, and I'm sure in many of your dorm rooms, as we continue to probe the heart and the mind of Mrs. Lars Grin. Let's welcome her this morning. And being that, again, this is the kickoff for our missions conference, we have designed this morning's program in a way to address that specifically, to give Mrs. Lars Grin an opportunity to share with us some of her missionary experiences. And we'll begin that by asking you to give us two essential qualities that you believe are necessary for any missionary.
Two essential qualities. My brother, Dave Howard, he's a missionary, and he does a tremendous lot of traveling around the world and speaking. He's much more than I do. I never know what continent my brother Dave is on. But I asked him this question one time, and without any hesitation, he said flexibility is at the top of the list. Especially nowadays where young people have so many qualifications. Most of you would have a resume of several pages, I suppose. You've got all kinds of degrees and you've had all kinds of summer programs and mission programs and you're about to embark on one of those today. And there is such an array of choices of careers and job descriptions and all of that that it's sometimes difficult to remember that we are servants. And a servant is at his master's orders, nothing else. He doesn't have any input at all. And as I said to the young women last night in the women's forum, you don't define the terms of your discipleship. You are like a soldier under orders, and it's your master who defines the terms. In other words, for example, you don't say to the Lord, well, I'll go to the mission field if you'll make me a married woman. If you'll give me a husband. And when you get out to your job assignment, whether it's this immediate one that begins today, or whether it's a year from now or 2 years from now, when you get to what you think is to be your life work, I can tell you right now that it's going to be quite different from what you envision. In my experience, the will of God is always very different from what we imagine it to be. And the test of your trust in the shepherd is the willingness to do what lies on your doorstep when you get there. The willingness to move with the Spirit of God and not to just say, oh, well, that's not what I came out here to do, or that's not my job, that's so-and-so's job. And some of you might have felt that way this morning about the moving of chairs. Now, I realize that for some of you, maybe it's impossible to stay even 5 minutes after this because you are going places. But as Amy Carmichael said, there's no calculating the value of a servant, a missionary who will come to the field ready to do whatever needs to be done. So flexibility is perhaps at the top of the list. I'm not sure which should be at first or which second, but the second qualification that I would say is a servant heart. The willingness to get down on your knees and wash feet, figuratively or literally, if that's what it happens to be. That's the need that lies before you. Jesus did exactly that when he was on his way to the cross. And it says in John 13, that chapter where it tells about his washing the disciples' feet, that he now did this to show the full extent of his love. Now, how do you show the full extent of your love? Not by doing some grand and glorious thing, but by doing the very humblest and perhaps dirtiest job for which you are not likely to get thanked. That will show the full extent of your love. Jesus, after all, was on his way to the cross. You would think that he would be showing the full extent of his love on the cross. But he was getting across a very important lesson to his disciples, who were not all going to be crucified. They would not all have the privilege of being nailed to a bloody cross in public shame. But every single one of them would be given the opportunity, not once, but again and again, to do some humble task in his name. And so that's why he said, if I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you must wash one another's feet. So don't even think of becoming a missionary unless you are flexible and prepared to be a servant. Is that good enough, Dave?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so those are two essential qualities of the individual. What about preparation? What would you consider to be some of the paramount sort of things that would be necessary to prepare someone to be a missionary and be involved in mission work?
That's another question that I get asked quite often, and I probably don't give the answer that people are looking for. Usually young people want to know, what course should I take? What should I major in? What kind of summer work should I look for? How many degrees do I have to have and all that? And I really can't answer those questions. So it's best if you inquire of whatever mission board you might be interested in if they have specific requirements as to formal training. But my deepest concern is discipleship, that every one of you learn what it means to bring everything you are and have and do and suffer under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And that begins right here, right now, every day. In your student life, you have multiple opportunities every day to prepare for the, quote, great service, unquote, that God has for you later. And I don't think there's any line of demarcation in God's mind. You are his child now. You are his servant here and now. And graduation is not a big black line of demarcation in God's book. It's here and now that you're going to learn to obey him, or you're not going to be able to obey him anywhere. People ask me sometimes, what do you talk about when you travel around? And the truth is that I speak to many different age groups and many different kinds of groups. But the simple answer is, I talk about trust and obedience. And I think of Jim Elliot and the other four men, three of whom I knew quite well, or two of the others, I knew three of the five men quite well. And I know that they did not become heroes or martyrs or whatever other adjectives or titles might be given to them now in view of their dramatic death. They didn't become that after they got to that beach in the jungle where they were speared. They began when they were students. And Jim Elliot, for example, sacrificed 1 hour of sleep in the morning in order to have time to be alone and quiet with the Lord before classes. And I don't know very many college men that don't prize their sleep, especially in the morning. College men never seem to pay much attention to their need of sleep at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night. But the next morning is a different story. And if you are going to arrange to meet God in order to get your orders for the day, you're going to have to start the night before, which means that you're going to sacrifice some social activities, perhaps the evening before, and you're going to have to sacrifice some sleep in order to take that time alone with God. So that's just one tiny point. But it is a very crucial part of your preparation. Because if you don't have that firm, solid rock foundation that you just sang about a few minutes ago, you're going to collapse. You will be one of the thousands of missionary casualties. I love that hymn that we sang at the beginning, On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand. All other ground is what? Sinking sand. Now, maybe you don't believe that now, but the time is going to come very soon when you will. And I love especially the second verse. That's been a tremendous encouragement to me in some of my worst times. His oath, his covenant, his blood support me in the whelming flood. When all around my soul gives way, He then is all my hope and stay. And I can tell you, young people, that things will happen which will shake everything in you that is shakable. Mark my words. Don't forget, you heard it here first. Everything in you is going to get shakable, and probably some of the worst shakings are going to come through other Christians. That's a sad fact, but it's the truth. So when all around your soul gives way, he then must be your hope and stay. So you learn today to get your feet on that solid rock. God help you.
You mentioned flexibility. Maybe we could just expand on that somewhat. Do you believe that a missionary often finds that they are required to do things that are not found on their formal job description?
Well, yes, I would say, is the Pope Catholic? Most emphatically, yes. Now, I'm not in touch with the formal requirements of very many mission boards nowadays, and I know they're much more complicated than they were back in my day. If I'd had to go through the psychological screening and the various grids that modern missionaries have to go through, I would never have made it. There's no question about that. But I've never met a missionary who didn't say that that was indeed what happened, all sorts of things that he did not feel prepared for and had no formal training for turned out to be part of his job. For example, when I went to Ecuador, I went because I believed that God had called me to be a linguist, to reduce unwritten languages to writing, and then to start translating the Bible. And I was prepared for that. I had majored in Greek in college, and I went to University of Oklahoma to take linguistic training, and God had given me a gift for that. But how much of my time do you think I actually spent literally reducing the language and doing Bible translation? I think I would be very generous if I said maybe 10 or 15%. The rest of the time you spend sleeping. Of course, you spend one-third of your life probably sleeping. And if you live in the jungle, you spend at least another whole third just surviving, because you don't have all the time-saving devices that you had here, and it just takes a whole lot more time to chop wood and haul water and fix a kerosene refrigerator and pump out gasoline pressure lamps and things like that if you're living in a primitive situation. But then I found out that I had to become a foreman. When my husband died, we had about 40 Indians who were responsible for keeping the airstrip cleared with machetes. We didn't have any power mowers or anything like that. So it was like this by hand, and it took about 40 of them to do that. Well, who was the foreman? Me. I had never been a foreman before with 40 people working under me. I had to learn to run a diesel generator, which Jim had installed so that we could have electricity about 2 hours every evening in order to do some of the work that we needed to do without having to constantly repump the gasoline pressure lantern. I had to learn to deliver babies, give shots, injections, diagnose jungle diseases, on and on. I could go on and on with all the little things, but you need to revise your thinking about what is God's work, as Amy Carmichael had to do, switching from an itinerant evangelist, which she did for about 6 years, to taking care of babies, which meant bottles and formulas and diapers. All of this is the work of God. So just remember whom you serve. Do you serve the Lord Christ? If so, you will be willing to deliver the babies and wash the bottles and move the chairs.
Of course, this morning again, you're addressing a student body, so that we have many people who are finding it difficult to balance a variety of priorities, their classwork, their jobs, and then of course someday many of them will be married as well, and then there's ministry and in a local church that they're involved in now, and they'll be involved in as married couples, and then many will have children, and then they add that to their list of priorities. You've been on the field as a single lady. You were on the field as a married person. You were on the field as a married lady with a child. And then you were on the field as a married, as a widowed lady with a child. And in all that time, I'm sure there was many opportunities for you to assess and evaluate and try to juggle priorities. Maybe you could address that for us and give us some insight on how maybe we could do the same thing.
Well, I suppose that's one of the most difficult questions that all of us wrestle with for the rest of our lives. It certainly is a very real part of my present work. If I get two speaking invitations, for example, for the same day, which do I take? How do I know what to do? And I don't have any simple rule of thumb for that in a practical sense. I asked this question of Billy Graham many years ago, and I had an opportunity to talk to him. I said, how do you set priorities? Because his secretary had told me that at that time, at least 25 years ago, he was receiving 8,000 invitations a year for speaking. I suppose by now it's 80,000. And when I asked him this question, he said, I don't have an answer. He said, I have never been able to work out any kind of a policy. So I know this isn't the kind of an answer that you want, because it's not an easy one, but it is a simple one. You know the difference between easy and simple. You can understand the simple one. You can't always find it easy to put it into practice. But in John 15, Jesus said, dwell in me as I in you. And that phrase, dwell in me or abide in me, is repeated over and over again in that 15th chapter of John. And for years, I tried to figure out what it means to abide. How do I abide in Christ? If I am abiding in Christ, then I believe that day by day, as I seek the Lord in prayer and lay before him the possible options, that he will guide me. But I couldn't really grasp this idea of abiding until relatively recently, when I finally saw that it is explained very simply in verse 10. Jesus says, dwell in my love. If you heed my commands, you will dwell in my love, as I have heeded my Father's commands and dwell in his love. So dwelling in his love means being obedient. And you say, well, that takes us back to square one. How do I know whether God wants me to do this or this or this? Now, try to hear me on this. All of us know certain things that God does want us to do. Love your brethren. Be nice to your wife. Don't lie. Be hospitable. There are just lists and lists and lists in Scripture of the things which characterize a Christian. If we are doing the things that we know God wants us to do faithfully and for his glory, then all these other things which we cannot find a verse for in the Scripture will fall into place. And I have found this again and again and again. Every day it works. When I'm doing what I believe God wants me to do, loving my husband, for example, forgiving my husband if I need to do that, being submissive to him, these are constants. And as soon as I get down to say, well, now, Lord, I don't know whether to do this or this or this, it may very well be that at that point the Lord brings to my mind some way in which I need to correct something that I know was his will. And when I correct that thing, then the Lord makes clear what I'm to do next. Now, he doesn't give me audible voices. He doesn't give me any handwriting on the wall. He doesn't give me any pillars of fire or any stars of Bethlehem. Most of our decisions must be made on the basis of common sense and intelligence, looking at all the evidence and all the facts surrounding each case. And then you simply do the next thing. And as you do the next thing, God shows you the next thing. It's not nearly as 1, 2, 3 as you wanted it to be, is it? And yet it comes right down to learning what it means to walk with the Lord one day at a time, abide in his love.
Thank you. Of course, we're all familiar with the couple of major setbacks that you have experienced in your life, with the deaths of your first and second husband. But in reading one of your books, in fact, your newest book on Asking God Why this morning, I realized in reading that you're still struggling, as we all struggle. And it was kind of comforting this morning to know that it's not just the large things, but even the daily things that you're facing, as we all face, and trying to sort through them, figure out what it is God's purpose is to mean and to be in our lives. And what I'd like for you to share with us, I recall hearing you speak some time ago, and you mentioned that you had experienced on the mission field a setback involving your translation work. In the midst of that, I think that some of the work that you had been doing was either stolen or washed away or destroyed. And there was various things in that particular evening that you shared with us, with the group, about the setbacks that you had experienced and how you had viewed those and worked through those and how you saw God in those. And maybe you could share some of that with us this morning.
Thank you. I'll be glad to. The first year that I was a missionary, before the first year was up, there were four huge blows to my faith. And this will illustrate what I said at the beginning, that things are going to be different from what you expect. When you reduce a language to writing, obviously you have to find an informant, some speaker of that language who will sit down and, with the endless patience that it takes, repeat his language over and over and over again for this apparently retarded foreigner. I mean, it is a boring job for anybody who knows nothing about language learning. And if you've never learned anything but your mother tongue, you have no consciousness of what it takes for somebody to learn a language. So God answered my prayer for an informant by giving me a very unusual man who not only spoke Colorado, but also Spanish. I didn't expect to find somebody who was also a Spanish speaker. And of course, I had to learn Spanish first, since it's the national language of the country. So we worked together very happily, bilingually, which is much faster than monolingually. And he was murdered only after about 6 weeks of working together. That was a huge blow to my faith. Was God still in charge? If he was, why would he allow a thing like this to happen? The only man in the world who spoke those two languages, that's what this man was, literally the only person in the world that spoke both languages. And God allowed him to be killed. And then a baby that we missionary women were asked to deliver died in the delivery, and the mother also died. And this was a case where we had been praying for the family and particularly hoping that the Lord would change the hearts of the three men who owned this one woman and who used her. I don't think any one of them knew who was the father of that child. The fact that she died made them turn even more furiously against us, because it was all our fault, of course. The third thing was that all of the station on which my fiancé, Jim Elliott, was working over in the eastern jungle was washed out by a flood. All five of the buildings that he had been working on, three that he had built from the ground up and two that he had repaired, all of them were destroyed by a flood, went down the Amazon in one night. And then the fourth thing was that all of the language materials that I had amassed during that year, and I did succeed in reducing the Colorado language to writing, even though my informant had died. It was a longer, more difficult process, but I had finally done the job, and all of that language material was stolen. So it brings you right down to that solid rock. And if solid rock is not there, you're in trouble, because all around your soul gives way. He then is all my hope and stay. And his oath, his covenant, his blood had to support me then in the whelming flood. And the great question comes at such a time: whose am I? Whom do I serve? And what is this for? And one of the most crucial passages to me for any missionary, any servant of God, is 2 Corinthians 4, which has come alive to me over these years. But in 2 Corinthians 4, Paul says, we are no better than pots of earthenware to contain this treasure. And this proves that this transcendent power does not come from us, but is God's alone. Now remember today, young people, when you go out to your assignments, I'm sure that there are many of you sort of trembling in your boots and thinking, well, I don't know whether I'm going to be any good at this or not. Well, let me tell you in advance, you're not going to be any good at it. You are pots, clay pots, but you have a priceless treasure. Or to use the metaphor of John 15, you're nothing but a branch. And the branch is utterly useless if it's separated from the vine. Jesus said, without me, you can do how much? Nothing. Without me, you can do nothing. You're a clay pot to contain this treasure, but the transcendent power is God's alone. And then Paul goes on to describe a missionary's life. Hard pressed on every side, we are never hemmed in. Bewildered, we are never at our wit's end. Hunted, we are never abandoned to our fate. Struck down, we are not left to die. You may feel hard pressed, bewildered, hunted, and struck down before today is over. But here's the key. This gives us clues to what's happening. Wherever we go, we carry death with us in our body. The death that Jesus died, that in this body also, life may reveal itself, the life that Jesus lives. For continually while still alive, we are being surrendered into the hands of death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be revealed in this mortal body of ours. Thus, death is at work in us and life in you. So whatever these little deaths are that you are asked to die today and every day, remember that if you belong to Him, and if the work that you do is His, the results are His business. Why would God allow my whole year's work on the language to be stolen? We prayed, of course, that God would get that suitcase back. It wasn't going to do anybody else any good. But we didn't get it back. And so the question was, what am I doing here? Is it working? Is it for nothing? But death had to go to work in me in all kinds of ways, little unseen ways and bigger things that other people knew about. What for? So that life may be revealed in you, in somebody else. And every one of us is meant to be that clay pot. I am no more than you are. I'm nothing but a clay pot. And there wouldn't be any point in my being invited to stand up here and speak to you if I were anything else. But a pot is made to carry something, to bear something. And the scripture tells me that it is a priceless treasure. And so I come as only a vessel, and the transcendent power belongs to God. Remember that. Today, when you go out.
Well, thank you for bringing that fact up, that you are just a vessel like the rest of us. In fact, my wife last night on the way home in the car said, I will never, ever attempt at speaking in public again after hearing Mrs. Grin. I think that we see you up here and we hear you talk and relate these stories. And I know it's difficult for me and others to really fathom some of the things that you have faced in your life and to still be standing here so in control, it seems, of what is going on. I would like for you to share with us. I know that in the book this morning that I was reading that you mentioned that there are times that you face confusion, you face periods when it just doesn't seem like that God is making His ways clear to you, that there is still an element of mystery that is a part of our lives. Maybe you could share with us, just so that we expand on the clay pot theme, some of those times when really you have felt a little overwhelmed by the confusion and mystery of God's working in your life. Or are you all, are you always exactly as we see you right now? It just is. I would like for our young people, and so I can relate this to my wife as well. That you don't just wake up out of the bed and say, good morning. And,
No, I think this would be a good place for Lars to come up and answer that question. Am I always just as I am now? Most certainly not. And I think that it would be quite accurate to say that there is never a day that goes by when I'm not tested in some way. And this morning, my husband and I had a small discussion over breakfast. I wouldn't call it an altercation, but we were referring back to what was an altercation yesterday and the day before. And as I've often said when I speak to people on the subject of marriage, if a sinful man and a sinful woman are going to live together 365 days a year, it's going to take an awful lot of grace, and it's going to take a good many times of saying, I'm sorry, please forgive me, and I forgive you. Because the truth is, there isn't anything else to marry but sinners, is there? Don't you forget it. You know, that perfect 10 that you think you see is going to turn out to be full of surprises. And when I am concentrating on the fact that here I am stuck with a sinner, it's a good idea for me to remember, and so is he. He has to put up with me as well. So I'm not going to let you in on the secrets, Dave, as to exactly what we were discussing. But believe me, there are some, let me say, solemn moments. Lars and I don't get into shouting matches. I don't even think that that's a temptation for us. But do you know what it's like to go silent and not want to speak a word? And that's really what I felt like doing this morning. And sort of facetiously, I just said to Lars, well, don't speak to me. I'm not going to address another remark to you. While I was smiling, and we ended up laughing, and he gave me a hug. But here's what's happening, though. You see, as long as I'm getting up and dishing out the truth of God to other people, whether it's to one person or to 10 people or to 500 people, Satan is not going to like that. And so he is going to do everything that he can to undermine. And it's much easier for Satan to undermine my personal, private life. And so he's going to come at me day after day after day with very ordinary human temptations. And it is at that point that the Lord, the Spirit of God, speaks to me and says, all right, here's this tiny thing, seemingly tiny thing. But if your response is no, Lord, instead of yes, Lord, you're in big trouble. A very tiny thing can lead to big trouble. On the way to California, we had a layover in St. Louis, and I lost my pen. I knew that I'd had it in the airport, and I knew that I didn't have it when we got on the plane for California. Now, I pride myself in being very organized. I know exactly where everything is. I have a place for everything, and everything is in its place, supposedly. The pen was not in its place. I have a neat little case for it, and both the case and the pen were gone. And that's just a reminder that I am a failure. And I hated to admit to my husband that I had lost my pen, because I knew he was going to be angry with me for my losing the pen, because I couldn't tell you how many pens I've lost. And I'm not going to tell you how many he's lost back at the book table. He either comes home with no pen when he started out with three, or he comes home with six pens when he started out with none. So six other people have lost pens. You know, anyway, we're terribly human.
Okay, thank you very much. One last quick question before we give some of you an opportunity to come to one of the two mics. We have two mics set up and the two aisles here to my left and to my right and to my left. But before we do that, let me ask you a little more mundane question perhaps. I think the last figure I heard was that something like 20,000 Christian books a year are published. And obviously we're going to have to set priorities on who and what we read. Of course, accepting the Bible and accepting your own works and accepting John MacArthur. who could you possibly recommend for us to read? Something that would be challenging to our souls, someone that would possibly a book that has been particularly powerfully used by God in your life.
Thank you for that question. Anything at All by C.S. Lewis. My second husband, who was a professor in a seminary, used to say, we wouldn't need a seminary if we could get all these students to read everything C.S. Lewis ever wrote, because once Lewis has said a thing, it has been said as well as it will ever be said. So I would say, by all means, get your hands on anything and everything that you can by C.S. Lewis. The same thing goes for George MacDonald. Now, a lot of George MacDonald's novels have been published more recently in abridged and mutilated forms. I have the original forms, and they are rich and packed with meat. A lot of the meat has been cut out and some of the fat left in the modern forms, but even so, they're good novels, they tell me. I haven't read any of these, I haven't read them all the way through, but the books by Roland Hine that are selections from MacDonald's sermons, unspoken sermons, and also C.S. Lewis's anthology of George MacDonald is a treasure. And anything by Amy Carmichael. As some of you know, I've written a biography of Amy Carmichael, and I would hope that that biography will whet the appetites of the readers so that they will go on to read her books. She wrote about 40 books. 14 of them are still in print, and they are listed in the back of my biography. So get those 14 books. They are classics, spiritual classics, and she had a profound influence in my own call to the mission field and in my own understanding of what the life of the cross is about. It's the most practical, down-to-earth stuff that you'll ever read that will help you in the rest of your life, especially in missionary work.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we turn it over to you now? We have two mics, and what we would like to do is just let you... Did we set an age limit on who could ask questions? And what we, before this first student speaks, we want to remind him and all of you that we want to put just a little bit of guidelines on your questions that you would ask. Try to constrain yourself to one question, and then also to be mindful that there will be others wanting to ask a question. So if you would be very concise, so that we can cover as much ground as possible. Yes, son.
Since some of us may put you on a pedestal, I thought, do you ever have experiences on the road that, should you even think of yourself as up there, might topple you a little bit, like a ride to the airport or that you had in Norfolk and the church up in...
I didn't hear that last part.
The ride you had up in Norfolk, Virginia to the airport one time and a church in New England where you were standing being introduced or waiting for the lady to meet you at the door?
Oh, the latter I can remember. I don't know what you're talking about, the ride to Norfolk, but...
From the TV station.
Oh. I was on a certain Christian talk show one time, and as I was being driven to the airport by the young man whose job it was to drive speakers back and forth, I was making casual conversation with him, and I mentioned that I had been entertained in a very, very nice hotel and that they had given me a beautiful room. And he said, yeah, I said, they really got some nice rooms over there, but man, you ought to see the ones they give the biggies. So I knew exactly where I stood in his view. And one lady met me at the door when I arrived at a church where I was to speak, and she said, you're Elizabeth Elliot? She said, wow, you sure look a lot older than your pictures. Guess that's what Lars means. They don't really take me down very much because I think they're so funny that I love to tell stories like that. But let somebody really insult me or my husband insult me, and that's much tougher.
Thank you. Yes, right here.
Was it hard for you to go from being a missionary to a writing and speaking career?
No, I don't think it was hard at all. I've heard lots of people talk about the huge adjustments, and I've heard missionaries often say, well, I've been home in this country for 25 years, but my heart is still in Africa. I've never felt that way, because when God opens one door, he closes the other one behind you. And it came about in a most unexpected way. I never imagined that I would ever be anything but a missionary, a foreign missionary. And in the providence of God, the job of writing was dropped in my lap when Jim died, and one thing leads to another. So it's just been a matter of one step at a time and one day at a time. God gives strength and grace as he opens new doors. Thank you for that.
Yes.
You were in the position of being a single, what we would call a single mother, for a number of years. Could you give us any words that we could use to encourage others that are in that position, either through widowhood or through divorce?
Yes, the Bible is full of special promises for widows and for the fatherless. So I would encourage you to look those up in your Bible. People have asked me sometimes, how could you be both mother and father to your daughter? And my answer is very simply, I couldn't possibly. God had taken her father. I had to trust him to make up to her in ways that I couldn't even imagine for the loss of her father. I had to be her mother, and that's all I could be. And so it was just one day at a time, trusting God to give me the wisdom and the grace to do all that a mother can do by herself for that child. I don't think I have any neat tricks.
I have a question about your daughter. When you brought your daughter with you back to Ecuador, a lot of times missionaries' kids have a bitterness, or they don't really feel that they are a part of your ministry. What was your daughter's attitude, and did you struggle with that at all?
My daughter, if she were here, she would be glad to answer the question. She feels very fortunate that she grew up in the jungle, and she would love to raise her children in the jungle of South America or Africa, where her husband grew up, rather than in the jungle of Orange County, California, which is where they live. Because Valerie was always with me and was very much a part of my work, she never had any reason to feel abandoned. Jim and I had discussed homeschooling long before that term was even invented. We were planning to educate our children ourselves because we violently disapproved of sending children away to boarding school, at least until they get to high school. So we were planning to homeschool as many children as the Lord gave us, and we hoped we would have a big family. Valerie was only 10 months old when her father was killed, so I did homeschool her until we came back to the States. So she was with me when I went to Indian houses. She went. When Indians came to our house, she was there, and she spent a lot of time with the Indians without me. So it didn't cross either of our minds that in any way she would feel abandoned. I'm sure that many missionary children are bitter because they've been sent away to school or because they felt that for their parents the work came first. And I don't think that it's necessary for that to happen.
And we also understand Valerie is married to a minister as well, a Presbyterian minister.
Yes, her husband was a missionary kid in Africa, and he is now a minister in Laguna Niguel.
Yes.
How are you able to go back to the tribe and minister there that killed your husband? Was it hard for you?
That's a long story, which I don't have time to tell this morning. It is told in the book called The Savage, My Kinsman. I had told the Lord after Jim died that if there was anything he wanted me to do about the Aucas, I was available, thinking that it was a pretty safe prayer, that God was not likely to ask a widow with a baby to do what five men who had been strong and able young men, three of them actually were armed, had gotten killed doing. So it was a surprise when God did take me up on that and in a very remarkable way opened a door, enabling me to make contact with two Alka women who then lived with me for almost a year in a Quechua home and eventually said, we're going home, we'd like you to go with us. And so my daughter and I and Rachel Saint went with them and lived, as I think I told you last night, my daughter and I lived with the Alcas for 2 years and then went back to Quechua work.
My question is somewhat along the same lines that the answer may be too long to give. Jim Elliott's death has been mentioned several times, and I don't know that all of us know the circumstances of that death and how you found out about that death and your immediate response to that.
Jim and I and many other missionaries had been praying for years for the Alcas, the tribe that we knew was the only one in Ecuador that had never been reached by missionaries. In fact, no one had ever returned alive from Alca territory. People had gone in there looking for oil and rubber and gold and had not come back. So we knew the reputation of these people. They were killers. They were naked. They were Stone Age. We didn't know much of anything else. But over a period of about 15 weeks, three of the five missionaries took part in what was called Operation Alca, dropping gifts to the Alcas after the pilot had discovered their houses from the air. And it looked as though, in every way, that the Alcas were indeed accepting their gifts in a friendly way, and the men felt that the time had come to attempt to reach them face to face on the ground. And so they had gone in to the edge of Alca territory and set up a camp. And when on the evening before their departure, they had sung this hymn that we sang this morning, "We rest on thee, our shield and our defender." We wives, of course, were back on our own stations waiting for word. The men had a shortwave radio, and daily they called in to the aviation base and reported what was happening. On the fifth day after setting up the camp, we received word that they had had a friendly contact with three Alcas, and the men were extremely excited. Everything had gone beautifully. And 2 days later, they were to call in at 4:30 in the afternoon after Nate had seen 10 Alcas on their way from the Alca houses over to the missionary camp. So he had called his wife at that time and said, "We're very excited. There are 10 Indians headed for our camp. We'll call you again at 4:30 this afternoon." And at 4:30, there was nothing but silence. It wasn't until the next morning that I knew anything had happened or gone wrong, because I was not on the radio the previous afternoon. I was on my station and got a call that morning, Monday morning, from Marge Saint, the pilot's wife, telling me that nothing had been heard from the men since the previous noon. And so another pilot was going out to see if he could find out what had happened. He flew over the beach, reported back at 10 o'clock that morning that all he could see was the plane stripped of its fabric, which we knew meant something serious, but there was no sign of any of the men. And, of course, no further radio contact. So it was 5 days before a ground party was able to reach their camp, and on the fifth day they reported back to us by radio that all five of the men had been speared to death. At the time when I received the word that my husband was missing, on that Monday, the Lord brought to my mind the words from Isaiah 43, verse 2, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee, for I am the Lord thy God." And I knew then that God was not promising me that he was going to bring my husband back. But he was promising that he would be there. And he was.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Yes, yes, sir.
I'd like to maybe change the subject just a little bit. You had the opportunity to attend Wheaton College during a period of time when numerous men were turned out of that institution that basically set the tone for evangelicalism in America for the next 30 years. And since then, you've had an opportunity to be involved on many college campuses. I would like for you to maybe just give some observations as to, number one, what you see as the major differences on college campuses, maybe in terms of student life, when you were at Wheaton as opposed to today, and then secondly, the kind of vision that you see on the college campuses, maybe a comparison.
Okay, I would say that the major difference that I see is lack of commitment today. And that covers a broad span. I don't see the kind of commitment that college students, serious college students in my day, seem to have. And by commitment, I mean making a decision and carrying a decision into action and sticking with it. As I talk to young people, I find them desperately unable, pitifully unable, to come to final decisions about anything. Now, I realize that you cannot make final decisions about careers and things which are changeable, because God doesn't give you a blueprint for your whole life. But you do have to make at least two decisions which are irrevocable in your life. And one of them is whether or not you're going to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And Jim Elliot made that commitment when he was in high school. And that was a lifetime decision which was never again up for grabs. And if you are determined to follow Jesus Christ and to do his will, cost what it may, then that simplifies your life. It is an enormously simple thing in most situations to ask yourself, is this right? Is this what would please the Lord? Or am I doing this for myself? You can always ask that question. And the second decision, which is irrevocable, is that of marriage. Now, you can find out the will of God. And I believe that young men are filled with fear about commitments. Fear that they're going to make the wrong decision about career. Fear that they're going to marry the wrong woman. Fear that they're not manly enough to be the husbands that they know they ought to be. Fear of what it means to bring children into the world, into such a terrible world. And you hear somebody tell you that it's going to cost you $180,000 for each child. And people say to my daughter and her husband, well, do you really think you can support all those children? And just this past weekend, we were in Oklahoma speaking at a Christian school where the headmaster was the father of 10 children. And I said, and what did you say to people when they said, can you support all those children? Can you put them through college? He just laughed. He said, you know, that's a lot of baloney. I said, one thing that people can never say to you is, oh, well, you're rich, and so you could afford it. You know, the headmaster of a Christian school is not going to be making a lot of money. But here's a man who had made a commitment. And one step at a time, you ask God to help you. I think what happened back at Wheaton was there was one phenomenon that's very obvious, and that was that we were there just after World War II, and many of the students had been in the service, the armed forces, and they had been all over the world, and they had come back with a vision for foreign missions. And it would be very interesting if somebody would tally up the number of faith missions that were founded right then in the 40s by Wheaton men. I'm sure that there probably were dozens and are still going today. But these men had seen with their eyes the needs, and they came back with a serious vision of what they wanted to learn at Wheaton College, and they stirred up those of us who had never been overseas. Now, you people have a similar advantage in having been overseas, many of you. I'm just amazed at how young people get around. Are you prepared to make a commitment to Jesus Christ? Lord, I'm going to do your will, no matter what the cost, and never again negotiate that decision. And are you prepared, you men I speak to this morning, to get down to business with God now and quit dating and ask him to show you his will for you in marriage and to lead you to the woman of his choice instead of you giving God a list and saying, this is what I've got to have? Just say, well, Lord, here's my list. You take it and give me your list and give me the woman that you want to lead me to. And I believe God will do that.
Thank you. Back over here.
Yes, it was over here.
If I understand correctly, you were in a unique situation or a special situation. You were a newlywed, married 6 months on the mission field, and you found yourself pregnant. Did that pose any special difficulties for you and your husband, and later on for you as a widow? And how did you deal with those?
Well, I think I've answered the last part of the question as much as I can. To be a widow with one child posed various challenges, shall we say. Certainly I was not upset by discovering that I was pregnant. In fact, I was upset by discovering that I was not pregnant sooner. I was very eager for a child. And that may strike you as very strange, and it would have struck me strangely if I had heard about it in advance, because when I got married, I was not dying to have a baby immediately. In fact, all I was thinking about was having this man, Jim Elliott. And we had discussed the fact that we thought it would be very nice to not get pregnant for at least a year. It'd be nice to have a year's honeymoon before we started seriously thinking about having a family. But you know, God has so arranged things that your desire is for your husband, and then when he gives you a husband, then he awakens in you a desire for fruition. And in God's book, love always produces fruit. And I was overwhelmed almost as soon as Jim and I were married, within the first month or so, with a desire for a child, and so was Jim. So we were very happy. It was wonderful news when I found out that I was pregnant. And my daughter has had a very different story, since she is the mother of six and the oldest is 12. And I think that some of her pregnancies have been a surprise and a shock, and she has not found it easy to say, "Yes, Lord." And yet it's very clear to me that she has accepted each child as a gift from God, and with real delight and gladness she has received these children. Jesus said, "Whosoever receiveth one of these little ones in my name receiveth me." And I don't think any woman who becomes pregnant should have any other attitude but that this is indeed God's gift and should be received in that way.